see. So the focus is on the self, and the self, one way of thinking about this is this, it's called presenting the self, this chapter, right? And there's a little bit of a play on words there because of the word presenting. Because what happens is the self sets itself up in time in a certain way. And that's where I want to start off, because it's really interesting and well, very important. So it's actually pretty clear when you're talking about story that that's connected to time. Usually we think of a story, you think of the most important part of it as the narrative. You know, first this and then that and then the next thing. So a story is something that unfolds over time. And the way the chapter talks about that is that the self is the agent responsible for organizing experience over time. And there is a reference in the very first sentence to descriptive and intentional knowledge. And in a very kind of simple way, descriptive knowledge is just looking at the past and describing it, and intentional knowledge is acting to accomplish certain intentions, certain goals, so it's looking to the future. So that's the dynamic, you know, between the past and the future, the stories of the self unfold. And part of what that means is it has to do with space. I mean, we're talking more now about time, but in the second paragraph in the chapter, the text says, when you're looking at objects, space disappears, and then when you're looking at the temporal view, what happens is that knowledge disappears in favor of the knowing of the self, which is shaped by its intentions, its concerns, its descriptions, and so on. But you could also just as well say that when you are focused on time, in the way that time unfolds in the story, that also closes down space, because this whole process of describing is a way of assigning labels and giving identities, and intentions do the same thing. I guess I don't want to try to work that out too much, but you might think about it a little bit, that all of these things interact. You know, once you're stuck in this kind of limited way of knowing and limited way of being, space disappears, time gets used up, and knowledge gets limited. Anybody have any comments or questions about that?
I do.
Yes.
Anyway,
good.
It's clear that it's a limited way of knowing and that it's narrow. However, what troubles me is having worked with people who have Alzheimer's and people who lose the thread of the story or lose the continuity or lose their ability to identify others, that doesn't seem like a very desirable or better way. So while the way we're talking about it seems limited, to not have that is worse.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point and helps clarify what this is about. There may be different ways to answer that concern, but the one that seems most important to me is I don't think TSK ever really says that we should give up the founding story or give up the ability of the self to make sense out of things. And actually, I think it's a really important point because there are meditative traditions where it sounds as though that's really what you're aiming at. I mean, you want to be able to realize a state in which all of these concerns of the self drop away and you find yourself in a state of nothing at all, you might say. And you know, you could say, well, that's very different from what you're pointing to, Hayward, with Alzheimer's, where the issue is that you can no longer make sense. That more mystical experience means that you've gone beyond making sense. But I don't think TSK necessarily goes in either direction. Of course, if anything, it goes toward the mystical, and you might have that kind of experience. It's possible. But really what TSK is saying is that you have to understand the story-making structure. You have to understand the way that the self operates. And if you can bring that deeper knowledge, that more fundamental way of knowing, one that is not dependent on the story, if you can bring that into play, then the capacity for telling stories is available to you without it filling up space and closing down time. So I may have mentioned in here before, and I forget, is Bruce here? No. Bruce would be happy to have me say this because it's based on a distinction that Ken Wilber makes, which I think is very helpful. He talks about confusing the pre and the trans, the pre-trans fallacy. And what he means by that is that you can think about something, you make a mistake if you take a situation which is before a capacity develops and confuse it with something where you go beyond that capacity. So in this case, you'd say if you have lost the capacity to make stories, to tell stories, you've got, you know, that's a very impoverishing way to be. But if you have the ability to go beyond the storytelling capacity, and that's the trans rather than the pre, that is important. And in TSK, there's a particular way of understanding what it means to go beyond. It doesn't mean necessarily that the stories disappear. It means that we no longer relate to them in a particular way.
And Jack?
Yes.
You made a remark when I said something about being stuck in daydreams, wishful thinking, and not getting out into the world, that related it to a shutdown in space. I forget your words. But, like, you lose space even more that way than if you're acting in the world. Maybe Alzheimer's is a bit like that. Like, you really get stuck in a curtailed environment where even the space of reaching out is effectively is being shut down.
Yeah, that's interesting. I you know, one of the things that strikes me about mental illnesses, I think we can call Alzheimer's a mental illness, something I've thought about, I don't know that I have a lot of insight, but is that you can clearly point to physical correlates. You know, you can clearly say that a Alzheimer's is the product of a diseased brain. And I think that our mental, our physical states, the state of the brain for sure, but also all the different systems that make up our physical embodiment, are kind of the input that we have, in the same way that, you know, when we open our eyes, we see a certain range of colors, and that's the input we have. I think our physical states are the input that we have, and then the stories are a way of reacting to those. That's not quite the right way to say it, because it's not as though first there's this non-story version of reality, and then we add the story. We already import the story into our reaction. But if the input is the kind of diseased input that you have in Alzheimer's or in some other kinds of mental illness, then, you know, the story is not going to be able to go outside that. The story is going to make sense of what's there. And the limiting case is when what's there is so restrictive, you could say, that the story can't make any sense at all. So I know I'm oversimplifying when I say that, but I think it's an important consideration. Actually, it has a little more to do with the reading for next week, which focuses on the difference between subjective reality and objective reality. So this is a way of saying that those two are not so separate from each other. Okay? If I talk long enough, I'll shut everybody up. That's good. No, it's something to think about. Okay, so the storytelling structure has to do with what's called, on the bottom of page 169, it has to do with creating a sphere of meaning. Right? You produce a world, and the description in this paragraph of how that's done is one of those places where, as you were saying, Michael, it's just very rich. There's a lot to work with there. But I think the point I wanted to make is just that meaning is so much at the center of our ordinary experience. And it's related to what you said, Hayward, that, you know, if you fall into a place where nothing, where meaning does not cohere, you've got a real problem. And I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but it's less than human. You know, it's less than our ordinary human capacities, let's say. So what we do is we make meaning. And of course, for the reasons that we're exploring here, meaning depends on time. And I just thought it was interesting to look back a little at the, because we were working for a couple of weeks there with models. And the thing about models is that models are timeless. And that makes them different from stories. They can't exactly say models are meaningless, but they're meaningless. Their meaning has to do with their explanatory power. It does not have to do with their significance for us. And so the classic example of that, classic in my mind, I guess, is the way that physics has a big problem, because in the descriptions that physics gives of time, all of the equations work the same whether time is moving forward from past to future or moving backwards from future to past. And you know, there are books written about this and conferences. There was a conference fairly recently about this because it's a real limit on the explanatory power of physics that it's got a model that doesn't distinguish between the forward flow of time and the possible backward flow of time, and yet we know in terms of the reality that's meaningful for us that for the most part, virtually all the time, you can only speak in terms of a moving from past to future. And so physics has this problem because its model, while it's meaningful in terms of explaining what's going on, is meaningless when it comes to trying to make sense out of our usual experience. So that's one way of distinguishing models and stories, in case that's been bothering you. So then the reading goes on and talks about these five persona of the self. I'm not going to try to go into that in any great detail, but what happens is that the focus pretty quickly becomes the narrator, the owner, and the witness, the fourth and fifth of these characteristics. The others they kind of provide the ways of structuring, but it's the narrator and the owner and the witness who actually do the structuring. And they're the ones who take over time, you could say. If you think of time as a dynamic that is fundamental to not just experience but reality, what happens is that the self as narrator and as the owner of experience uses that time to make its stories, and in doing that shuts time down. Actually, there's a nice statement right at the bottom of page 169. And the top of 170, that sentence, it says, acting as knower, interpreter, and meaning giver, the self seizes the past, authenticates the present and projects the unfolding of the future. So this is kind of the opposite of the physics problem. The model of time in physics is not making room for our real, our experience as we know it. This is taking time and making it nothing but the structure of our experience. And that's really what we want to be exploring. I don't usually refer to these, but if you have the book in front of you, you might want to look at, for a moment at the graphic on, that opens up this chapter on page 168, because I know some people are more visually based, and this might be helpful. This seems to me to be an example or an illustration, you could say, of what the self does. You know, the self is active in this big circle at the front of the image, and the image is basically of a cone, right? And so the cone looks back towards the past, and shapes it into this cone structure, and ultimately shapes it into this pie-shaped structure. And the way I think about these lines, it's just my interpretation, the way I think about these different concentric circles in the pie-shaped structure is that these are the models and structures and ways of making sense that the self imposes. But it does so on the basis of first taking hold of time and turning it into this present moment arising out of the past in the same way that this cone emerges out of a point. Right? And actually a little caption for the picture helps make that clear, or helps with that. Present, past, future, seizing and projecting, image of knowledge, self found, founds, founders, story discloses closed dimensions of knowledge. That stands on its own, although I noticed when I was working on with the people who were doing the Dutch translation of this book that word founder is not one that people necessarily understand, the English word, and it's kind of a nice image here. First the self, you could say, finds itself, right, constructs itself, and then it founds a reality, and then it founders. And foundering is what happens when a ship hits a rock and begins to sink. So that's what's going on here. Okay. Let's see. So if we go to page 171, where there is this focus on the narrator and the founding story is introduced, the key point, and I think it comes out very clearly in the chapter, is in the last paragraph on the page, where it says, "The stories told by the narrator self are about the needs, desires, feelings, experiences, projects, and understandings of the self." The self is always at the center of every story. And you could also... you could think about that in terms of time, and I'm going to make a reference now to something that is in Love of Knowledge, but I don't know exactly where it is. But at a certain point, Rinpoche makes this very interesting point. He says, what's the nature of reality? You know, how do we know that something is real? And you could answer that question in a lot of ways, but if you just take a kind of a common sense view and you say, as I look around me, everything that's happening now is real, and nothing else is real. And in that sense, you say that the present is real, and the past is not. I mean, it's real, it's true that the past happened, this is our ordinary understanding, but it's no longer there. And the future isn't real because it hasn't happened yet. So what makes something real is its existence in the present. And yet, and this is the point that Rinpoche makes, the only thing that's special about the present is that we are present in it. We're here. And that seems like a pretty funny foundation for reality, because somebody who was alive 500 years ago, their present was real because they were present in it. So why does our being present in this moment make this real? It doesn't, you know. And you could say, well, the past and the present and the future are equally real, but that's not how we usually think about reality. We think of reality as something that's going on right now. And the right now-ness of reality is completely due to our presence. So it's just a very clear illustration, I think, of how every story starts from the self at the center. And in the same way, reality is real because our self in this moment is at the center of the present moment. That's it. What is real is real because we are here, and that's it. And that's just the kind of biggest, most obvious example of how the self puts itself at the center.
Can I ask a question, Jack?
Sure, please.
You know, you referred to how physics is unable to really distinguish between the direction of time.
Right.
And yet, when you start talking about the narrator, the narrator is always looking in one direction through wants. And what's the difference? Like, without sort of assuming anything about linear time, what makes the self abiding in a moment look in one direction? What is that a direction in if linear time isn't there?
Well, if you take that question hard enough, far enough, maybe it's not such an easy question to answer. But if you take it to a certain level, which is what I'm going to do, it's a pretty straightforward issue, it seems to me. There's a nice line in Love of Knowledge that to me sums that up. Rinpoche writes, "The force of the self's desire unfolds as the momentum of linear time." So I know you just wanted to leave out linear time, but I think we have to kind of bring it in. The short version of that is the self reaches out. The self feels incomplete. The self, in a certain sense, knows that it's kind of a fraud, that it's just a story. And yet the story of the self is that it's more than a story, right? Is that it's real. And in order to go beyond that suspicion that the self is just making itself up as it goes along, it reaches out toward what is not the self. It's got to take hold of things. And that's a pretty conceptual way of looking at it. In terms of our experience, that shows up in a very different way. It just has to do with the self's desires and emotions, right? The self wants things.
The self goes along. What's it going along in?
I don't quite remember how I used that phrase, but let me just try to.
Something's unfolding. What's it unfolding in?
Okay.
Just in the narration or something else?
Yeah. So the question is there time first, and then the narrator kind of takes hold of time? I said that before, actually. I said something very much like that. But if you say that, then I think you also have to say that that's not time in the usual linear sense of past, present, and future. It's time more in the sense of a kind of dynamic. The linear time, which has its past, present, future structure and unfolds in that way, that is really a construct of the self and its desires and concerns. It's part of the narration. Now, it presents itself as being the background of narration. You know? The stories that the self tell unfold in linear time. But what the TSK vision and the way it's presented here, especially in Love of Knowledge, what they say is that's not right. That the very sense that there is a past, present, future structure depends on the story that's being told. So then you say, well, what would time be like if it didn't have that structure? Well, that's very worth exploring, you know. But it's not what we're looking at right now. We're looking at how the self is connected to that linear version of time.
Yeah,
Okay, let's see. Well, I was just going to say something about thoughts. If you're talking about stories, and especially when we think about the self stories, we usually are thinking of what is described in the text as a fully formed story. Like, we have a story about who we are, or we have a story about what's going on right now. We're in this this conference call, and it's part of this program in the TSK vision and so on. Those are the kinds of stories we think about. There are other kinds of stories. And I don't want to go too far into this, but there are other kinds of stories which are just really fragmentary. It's kind of like just a little glimpse of a story that we tell just in order to accomplish a limited purpose. I think I've used the image before of playing basketball, and so you've got to you have the ball. You're trying to get past the defender, or you could say the same thing in football or in any sport like that. And so you just make a little fake move. You just make a little move in one direction, and it's meant to put the other person off balance, and then you can get past them. And I think some of the stories we tell are like that, a lot of the stories, actually. There's just enough of a story there so that we can go on with the main projects of the self. So our version of the stories, our way of thinking about them, is very much these fully formed stories. But in fact, stories come in a lot of flavors and varieties, and some of them are really radically incomplete, you could say, but they're still stories. But even beyond that, there are we have certain kinds of experiences that don't really seem to qualify as stories. Well, you know, maybe if you push the image, if you push the idea of story far enough, what I'm thinking of is thoughts that just show up as images. So sometimes, if the mind is relaxed, maybe in meditation, or maybe if you're going to sleep or waking up in the morning, or just daydreaming, you know, daydreams of course tend to be stories. Dreams are stories in general. But sometimes what happens is there's just kind of a flow of images. You just see something. I don't know. It's kind of a fantastic scene, and then there's another one that replaces it immediately. And if you look closely enough, you might find a little fragmentary story connected with it. But what I'm thinking about now is just situations where you just have these little images. This kind of it's hard without having a specific example, but let's just say you have an image of a tree that comes into your mind, and then in the next moment you have an image of a desert, or you remember something that you have to do. So that little image of a tree, it doesn't seem like there's any story connected with it. And as I say, if you push hard enough, maybe there is. But it may be, and I leave this as kind of an open question. I don't know the answer to this, but it may be that those images are serving the purposes of the self story, of the founding story, in some way that we don't really know. Actually, one thing that occurs to me as I'm saying this is related to what I said before, about the physical input, the input of the body. It may be there's something that happens in the body and it gets translated by the narrator mind into an image. And if so, you could say that's just because the self has this tremendous need to make sense out of things. And taking a kind of a formless moment of experience and turning it into an image is a way of doing that. I'm thinking here of the passage on the bottom of page 171 where Rinpoche is describing all the things that the narrator self does, and we already read the first sentence in that paragraph, but then he gives a whole lot of other examples. He says, within their patterns, the self justifies, plans, and rehearses, judges, reasons, and feels emotions, desires and joys, rejects and suffers. the rules of logic and social intercourse, the vivid imagery of the human mind. So that's what I'm speaking of, is that particular phrase that's what we're talking about, the vivid imagery of the human mind, the interlocking domains of perception, feelings, naming, explanations, and interpretations, all take their meaning and significance from the manifold structures of the web of stories. So Rinpoche is really saying that stories are absolutely fundamental here. Absolutely fundamental. Even our perceptions, even our you know, our simplest sense of you know, there's a lamp in front of me, something like that, is really shaped by an underlying story. And that's a very worthwhile arena for inquiry. But, of course, we can't do much with it right now. It's just definitely something to look at, or at least to reflect on the fact that in this way of understanding, this model, because it is just a model, in this model, or you could call it a story, sometimes I've called it the story, in this story about stories, it goes all the way down. You know, there is nothing but stories all the way down. So I think that's, you know, there's a lot more we could have said, but I think we are pretty much out of time. So that's certainly plenty for this week. I'm in the guidance for next week. I'm going to suggest doing an exercise. It's TSK exercise 28, and I'll say something about that in the guidance. I just wanted you to be focused on that. And I guess I want to call your attention to just a couple of things before we close. This whole discussion of single-minded knowing, starting on page 174 and to the end of the chapter, it's really valuable, and it has to do with the sense of the narrator who is laying things out in a linear way from beginning to end. And it's worth comparing it. I think it's helpful to compare it to something we were looking at earlier in the program about multidimensionality. The single-minded knowing is just exactly the opposite of the multidimensionality that is available if space opens up. You know, if we can get in touch with the openness of space. And then I just wanted to call your attention to a phrase that I just love in this chapter. I'm probably because I'm too much infatuated with words, but it's in the first full paragraph on page 175, Rinpoche writes, "When knowledge is thus subordinated to the single-minded momentum of the founding story," and that's what I was pointing to, "experience eludes illumination." I love that phrase, and if you wanted to talk about the difficulty of our present way of being, or if you wanted to say what is it that makes it important to explore the TSK vision, I think you could just use those three words. You know, you could put that on your coat of arms or something, you know, and say, "Experience eludes illumination." That's the problem we have, and that's what we're working with. Okay, so I'll post the guidance probably, well, it probably usually doesn't go up till Monday because I'm not the one who puts it on the website. So it should be there by tomorrow.